Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Sociology. This is a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Anna Zhelnina, the host of this channel, and joining me today is Alexandrina Vanke, the author of the new book, The Urban Life of Workers in Post-Soviet Russia, Engaging in Everyday Struggle. This book was just published by Manchester University Press, and I'm very excited to have Alexandrina here with us today. Alexandrina, welcome to the show.
Okay, hi. I'm a sociologist. I'm a research fellow at the Institute of Sociology of the Russian Academy of Sciences. And I'm also a research associate on the project Deindustrialization and the Politics of Our Time at Concordia University in Canada.
Thanks for the introduction. And my first question is, so how did this book come about? Where does it come from?
I have a long-standing interest in qualitative research on class experiences. And for the first time, I turned to this topic when I was doing my candidate's thesis in sociology at the Russian Academy of Sciences. It was more than 10 years ago. That research looked at how blue-collar and white-collar men perceived their body and how they talked about it. After that, I was working on team projects on different topics, and we conducted them together with colleagues. This project looked at social mobility and inequality, the everyday life and culture of factory workers, as well as social, cultural, and territorial identities of post-industrial districts in Russian cities. And when I was choosing the topic for my PhD research at the University of Manchester, I decided to continue developing my research interests and developing my expertise in the everyday experiences of class. That's why I focused on the lived experiences of urban working class communities in post-industrial areas of Russia. This research underlays my new book. At the same time, in the book, I provide the examples from my previous projects and analyze some new ethnographic data.
And in your book, you mostly focus on working class people in two cities and in two working class neighborhoods. So could you describe the situation there and why is it interesting from the sociological standpoint?
For the last decades, working class people who live in the industrializing cities of Russia have faced numerous challenges. Similarly to other post-industrial countries, Russia's workers have become either invisible or replaced. And this has been caused by gentrification and increasing inequalities within these residential communities that now have mixed social compositions. It means that not only workers, but also professionals find these neighborhoods attractive for living life in them. This creates demands for new houses in the housing markets. That's why developers are constructing new multi-story house buildings in these areas. And this new housing coexists with the Soviet era social housing blocks where workers used to get flats from their factories. Of course, these processes intensify everyday inequalities in urban spaces. And these processes lead to narrowing public goods and sometimes closure of public places for workers. Apart from this, in deindustrializing areas, workers face a lack of classical working class jobs, I mean industrial jobs. And they have to look for positions in the enlarging service sector or create new jobs for themselves, like independent small businesses. We can find similar processes in such post-industrial countries like the US, the UK, Canada, and some others. This is particularly interesting for sociological theory because the issue of class is still important for our understanding of how inequalities work in society and how inequalities work in urban space. My multi-site ethnography, which I applied to local communities, can help us to extend further the sociological theory of class and inequality. And it also can help us to understand better how people react to inequalities and social injustice.
This sounds very interesting from the kind of the theoretical point of view, but what do these two neighborhoods feel like? Because I think this kind of atmospheres and the also the affective part of those neighborhoods are very important for your research. So what are they like, and why did you choose these two neighborhoods?
I start with my fieldwork, which was taking place in Moscow. It is the capital of Russia, and Yekaterinburg, which is the regional city located 1,800 kilometers east from Moscow. Both cities are post-industrial, but they are at different stages of deindustrialization. Within these two cities, I selected two industrial neighborhoods. In the book, I call them the Moscow neighborhood and the Yekaterinburg neighborhood to anonymize them. I selected them for several reasons. First, they both are former working class settlements, and they were constructed in the early Soviet era during the 1920s. They still have some industrial objects in their territories together with non-industrial buildings and post-Soviet buildings. The reason why I selected them is also that workers continue living in these neighborhoods. And at the same time, new middle-class residents either rent flats or buy flats in them. They are both located in the peripheries of the cities, and the atmosphere in them is like in urban villages, in suburban villages, where all residents know each other. The Moscow neighborhood was formed by two railway lines, and it has an industrial zone in its periphery. Its working class residents used to use this railway line to get to the automotive plant that was located in Moscow city center. And this automotive plant was shut down in the mid-2010s. The Yekaterinburg neighborhood was constructed around the heavy industry plant, which is still operating. It has a large social housing residential area together with recreational, leisure, cultural, and sport facilities. But from 1991, after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, these two neighborhoods followed different trajectories. And this was conditioned by different urban development strategies of Moscow and Yekaterinburg cities. At the moment, there are geographical and economic inequalities between two places. In the Moscow neighborhood, migrant workers form a large proportion of residents together with native workers and professionals. Moscow neighborhoods gets more funding for development and maintenance of its urban infrastructure. While in the Yekaterinburg one, local residents, including current and former factory workers and professionals, have to organize grassroots initiatives, helping them to maintain the urban infrastructure. And this infrastructure remained from the Soviet era. This creates different configurations of social relations between local residents in these two different places.
And I also found it really special in your book, the kinds of data that you use. And you also stated in the introduction earlier on that your project is basically based on multisensory data. So I'm very curious to hear more about how you conducted your research and what is it? What's this multisensory data?
The research presented in the book draws on multi-sided ethnography. This approach implies data collection in several locations. My research design included the classical methods of qualitative research, such as interviewing and observation, together with the creative method of drawing. During interviews, I asked research participants to draw their neighborhood and then to draw Russian society. I also asked them to explain what they drew. Additionally, I made sketches of real-life situations in wartime Moscow in spring 2022. Later, I turned the sketches into the book illustrations. Creative ethnographic fieldwork in two locations brought me qualitative data of different textures, formats, and forms. So this data included field notes, photographs and videos, interview audio recordings and transcripts, drawings by participants, and my own sketches. And I call this data multisensory because they allow me to explore multiple senses, including a sense of inequality, a sense of social justice, a sense of place and a sense of time, as well as a sense of local atmosphere that I analyze and theorize in the book. And even though multisensory data are hard to analyze because they are of different formats and textures, they help triangulate data. You know that data triangulation enhances research quality and it makes the analysis more comprehensive. In addition, this multisensory data opens the opportunity for the complex exploration of sensual experiences, imaginaries, and practical activities of local communities. Such a creative approach to multi-sided ethnography allowed me to reconstruct a multidimensional picture of everyday life of working class people, and at the same time examine their subjective perceptions of inequality and Russian society as a whole.
And what about your approach to writing? Because you also state in the book that your approach is alternative, or you use this alternative genre of writing. And I'm very curious to hear more about that as well.
Yes, sure. The Urban Life of Workers in Post-Soviet Russia is an academic monograph, but with elements of creative writing. And while working on this book, I was very reflexive about my discursive strategy. So I was thinking carefully about how I'm presenting my research participants, mainly workers from Russia's post-industrial cities, who do not have any access to the media. You know that workers are often represented negatively in the hegemonic media and even in the mainstream academic discourses. Such scholars like Stephen Roberts, Lisa McKenzie, Charlie Walker critically researched these stereotypical representations of workers. And in my book, I represent workers as a diverse group of people with different political views. Through classical and creative representational means, my book shows that Russia's workers are actively engaged in everyday struggle against neoliberalism and neo-authoritarianism. Workers invent the creative ways of overcoming life difficulties that I term everyday struggle. Written from the ordinary people's perspective, the book offers the alternative genre of writing about workers, drawing on the avant-garde literary tradition and creative writing. Apart from creative visuals, the book includes short poems and ready-made phrases, which inherits avant-garde aesthetics.
You already mentioned this key concept that you use in your book. It's everyday struggle. And I wonder if you could elaborate a bit more on what it is. And also, it's so central to the way you approach class, right? So maybe it's also an opportunity for you to discuss a bit more where you stand in terms of class analysis. How does your approach differ or relate to Bourdieu and Marx and other class theories?
By everyday struggle, I mean a wide range of practical activities of workers and a wider group of ordinary people. These practical activities are aimed at creative challenge and power imbalances, counteracting domination, reshaping the local landscapes, and improving life from the bottom up. This definition reviews James Scott's understanding of everyday resistance that is lacking a creative aspect. And my ethnography found this creativity in Russia. My definition also develops the neo-Marxist understanding of class struggle by historian E.P. Thompson and some other neo-Marxists. According to my theorization, everyday struggle of working class communities is embedded in their everyday life, allowing them to form practical consciousness within social material infrastructures. It means that they form this practical consciousness in their work, sometimes in their workplaces, but also in their places of residence. This resonates with Raymond Williams' understanding of culture as a whole way of life. In this sense, my sociological definition of struggle related to classed experiences of inequality is also critical, cultural, and ethnographic. According to my approach, everyday struggles are mediated by structures of feeling, which shape senses, imaginaries, and practical activities of local communities. And following Nick's Crossley development of the concept of radical habitus, my research suggests thinking in terms of habitus of resistance. Russia's workers form these dispositions of resistance through living life in post-industrial neighborhoods. This habituated resistance is manifested itself in meeting the neoliberal and neo-authoritarian challenges which are imposed on workers by the state. Among these challenges are social welfare cuts, neoliberalization of social goods and public spaces, the state control over people's urban life increased under the Russia-Ukraine war, as well as worsening of their living conditions caused by the economic sanctions imposed on Russia since 2022 and some other factors. That is why in my book, I suggest the concept of double resistance of Russian workers and ordinary people. My research revealed that this is double resistance to both neoliberalism and neo-authoritarianism, and it has gendered, peaceful, and environmental dimensions. This theoretical revision allows a better understanding of class consciousness that is being formed in everyday life and through mundane creative practice.
And I think it's also really interesting that for your class analysis, affect, feelings matter. They are very important, but also place matters. And I think this concept of local atmospheres that you use to describe the neighborhoods with also attention to class and how those experiences or feelings are classed is very interesting. So could you explain this concept of local atmospheres and why is that important for your analysis?
As I already said, the atmospheres in the Moscow and Yekaterinburg neighborhoods resemble those in urban villages. But the rhythm of everyday life is felt quick in Moscow compared to Yekaterinburg. At the same time, both places have their local atmospheres, which are informed by combinations of Soviet and post-Soviet structures. In both places, I did observation in the social era social housing yards, which had cozy atmospheres. And you know that such yards have semi-public places typically formed by 4 or 5 story social housing blocks, which were built during the 1960s under Khrushchev. And residents of these social housing blocks co-create yard atmospheres together. They participate in collective cleanups and greening activities. They decorate and domesticate the yard space with do-it-yourself objects. They chat and socialize with neighbors there, or just sit on the bench or play table games like chess or backgammon. Some research participants from both places told me that they spent their whole childhood in their yards. And in these yards, they acquired social skills of communication, which were shared within the community. The concept of social housing yard is important because it helps explore workers' sense of neighborliness, feelings to their place of residence, and their sense of belonging to the community. And the ethnographic exploration of a social housing yard helps us to reveal everyday inequalities.
And what about gender? Because you also talk about gender and how that relates to the sense of place and to how people navigate those residential areas. So how does that work? And could you maybe give us a couple of examples of how gender manifests in the urban space?
I'd like to start with a thesis that the physical space of the Moscow and Yekaterinburg neighborhoods is socially stratified. And in both places, I documented particular sites where working class men and women spend time, as well as migrant and native workers, younger and older people. And this made me think more about spatial inequalities, which emerge at the intersection of gender, class, ethnicity, and age. These intersectional inequalities are observable in the space of the industrial neighborhoods, and they form a particular gendered sense of place of working class people. For example, older women, working class women, babushki in Russian, often spend their leisure time by sitting on benches near entrance halls. And they monitor what is happening in the yard, and through this activity of controlling, they regain power and get respect from the residents. And there is very interesting research by Anna Shadrina, who explains how babushki, working class women, empower themselves through this controlling activity. At the same time, the position of a retired working class woman on the bench corresponds to her precarious social positions in social space, using Bourdieu's term. Another example is when working class men spend their leisure time by tinkering with cars in garages. Through these activities, they cultivate their masculine sense of place or spatial masculine habitus, or what Jeremy Morris conceptualized as automobile masculinity.
And what about intersectionality? Because you also introduced this concept, so it's not just gender. So how do you conceptualize that? How does intersectionality play out in your research and in your book?
I use intersectional approach as allowing me to look at the intersections and cross points of different factors that contribute to the emergence of inequalities in these spaces. So I focused on class, gender, age, and ethnicity because they were discussed by my research participants in the interviews. So these experiences, which were marked by class, gender, age, and ethnic markers.
And it's also very interesting that in addition to studying these things ethnographically, so basically doing it in a very traditional way, just going out, talking to people, visiting all these places, the working class pubs, hanging out with babushki on the benches, you also use this tool of drawing society, which I thought kind of deserves a bit more attention to. So how did you do it? Why do you think it's a good tool to explore inequalities, and how did you use it?
In my study, I use and develop further this method, a drawing of society, which was initially introduced by sociologist Alexander Bigbov, who used it in cross-national research on pupils and students' visions of inequalities. But I bring this creative method in ethnography of working class and middle class residents of industrial neighborhoods, as well as trade union activists. So this creative method helps me to visualize bigger social structures. Drawing allowed me to explore people's narratives about inequality. And later I classified them into three types. First, compliance with the social order, with this established order. Second, inversion of power hierarchy and challenging power hierarchy. And finally, subversion of power hierarchy. As for advantages, I think that the advantage of a drawing of society is that it helps to grasp people's social imaginary together with their sense of inequality and subjective perceptions of inequality. Moreover, such drawings contained irony of ordinary people, and they work perfectly as illustrations for presentations and the book.
And I think I should encourage everyone to get your book and have a look at all these wonderful plates, because you also have those drawings included as illustrations, right? Along with your own theoretical sketches and drawings. But there are also drawings by your interview participants, which is, I think, very, very special. So moving on to the next question, which is probably my big interest in general, and it's urban politics or politics in general. And you do talk quite a bit about politics, but also you add additional material to kind of facilitate this discussion of politics in Moscow and in Yekaterinburg, because apparently your interview participants in those neighborhoods don't necessarily engage in kind of the classic traditional ways of politics and protest. So you add this labor union chapter, which comes from a different project, as far as I understand. So could you talk about how politics is present or not present in the lives of these people, of your working class neighborhoods? And why did you decide to add this chapter on labor union activism?
Yes. You know that during the 2010s, social scholars were observing massive rallies, street rallies, labor protests, and trade union strikes in the large Russian cities. But by the end of the 2010s, these protest activities started facing more and more barriers and suppression from the state. And in today's Russia, the opportunities for open protests are significantly restricted because of the repressive nature of its neoliberal, neo-authoritarian regime. That is why workers and ordinary people are engaged in everyday struggle. This everyday struggle manifests itself in their creative, mundane resistance to both the state control over their urban life and worsening of their living conditions, as I already said, caused by the economic sanctions and the neoliberal economic policy of Russia. And by everyday struggle, I also mean workers' ways of overcoming life difficulties in such a context. And in the book, I provide the examples of grassroots activities that help workers and ordinary people take control back over their everyday life. And these forms of everyday struggle includes collective cleanups of the industrial neighborhoods, or for example, urban gardening and greening activities, or creating housing and communal art in yards, also known in Russian as ЖКХ art. And these micro activities allow workers to reshape the visual landscape of their places, and at the same time use the Soviet era depleting infrastructure as the sites of resistance to neoliberalization of urban space. In this context, workers become more and more engaged in shadow and informal economic activities, such as non-paying taxes, or they launch independent small businesses to create jobs for themselves. In addition, in spring 2022, I documented peaceful resistance, which was embedded in people's everyday life. And such kind of resistance include calling the war in Ukraine war in everyday talks. And this thing is still not allowed in Russia, because in Russia it is called special military operation.
And what about this other type of politics? You touch upon it, and it's related to immigration. So there are different ways of how immigration can become a political issue. You also have this very interesting kind of vignette or a story of a migrant worker in Yekaterinburg, I think, right? Who also kind of tells the story from the migrants' perspective, because also these neighborhoods experience a demographic change as well, right? So could you talk about that and how immigration is present, both kind of politically and experientially?
Experientially, it is very complicated, because I have a case in my book about the anti-migrant riot organized by the residents of the Moscow neighborhood, which took place in 2010s in the mid of 2010s. And on the one hand, local residents, native workers, were happy and said that migrant workers steal their jobs. But at the same time, there were also claims such as insufficient attention of the city council to their neighborhood and a lack of working class jobs in their area. So it is very complicated because native workers in the Moscow neighborhood, for example, live together with migrant workers. And this creates tension, intra-class ethnic tension between them. And at the same time, they cooperate with migrant workers, they work with them together in the same auto services, for example, or in the same workshops, and they have to communicate with them. But still, this is a kind of everyday xenophobia. And on the one hand, we can say that it is xenophobic attitude of native workers towards migrants. But at the same time, what is behind this xenophobia is economic and other types of inequalities created by the system and the social policy in Russia.
And kind of continuing this topic of politics and of different forms that politics can take, especially kind of manifesting at the neighborhood level, you wrote this book or finalized this book also against the full-scale invasion in Ukraine. So could you talk a bit about how did that, if at all, affected the everyday life of your interview participants of these neighborhoods, and how did you, what did you see, what did you notice?
The war in Ukraine reconfigured my field strongly. In spring 22, I did ethnographic observation only in wider context of Moscow. Unfortunately, I didn't revisit Yekaterinburg and didn't return to the Moscow neighborhood. Instead, I was observing how the urban landscape of Moscow was changing, with a particular attention to post-industrial neighborhoods in the city. And some of them I found green ribbons, an anti-war symbol used by people to express their disagreement with the war. My ethnography also documented anti-war inscriptions on the street walls, and all objects of blue and yellow colors were removed by the public from the public places by the communal and housing services of Moscow. And I finished writing the book in September 2022, before the Russian authorities announced a partial mobilization. And several months later, the flower protests intensified across Russia. This is not included in my book, but that's how the landscape of Moscow and other Russian cities changed. And you know that after a large number of civilians' deaths in both countries caused by military actions, people in Moscow and other cities bring flowers, candles, notes, and sometimes plush toys if children die. And through this everyday practice of laying flowers, people express their disagreement, showing their attitude towards the war.
I really appreciated that you could include this discussion in the book, although it's not kind of the main focus of your research, but I thought it really resonated well with the rest of the project. So I again will encourage our listeners to check your book out and look at all the wonderful visuals that you have included. But to wrap up our conversation, so this project is done now. It's published and looks like a nice book with pictures and everything. But what are you working on now? What's next for you?
So I'm currently exploring everyday environmentalism in post-industrial districts. And this follows my research interests in grassroots activities. Through creative ethnography, I'm studying environmental practices of Moscow city dwellers And in the future, I plan to expand the geography of my ethnographic study. This individual research is part of a large international project, Deindustrialization and the Politics of Our Time, conducted at Concordia University in Montreal. Within this project, I contribute to the theme Deindustrialization and the Environment by specifically looking at how post-industrial change affects the natural and social environments in deindustrializing areas. And following my book project, I have a particular interest in working class environmentalism.
This all sounds great and exciting. So we'll be looking forward to your next book then.
Thank you so much.
Yes, and thank you for taking the time. Thank you everyone for listening, and see you next time. So thanks, Alexandrina. Take care.
Thank you for having me.